It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get a preview of the Los Dells Festival that returns to Wisconsin this weekend. First, Governor Walker has declared a statewide state of emergency after a week of storms and flooding left severe damage across the state, from La Crosse and Coon Valley to Grafton and Green Bay. While some rivers are still expected to rise, a break in the rain is giving crews a chance to do some cleanup and rebuilding. The governor made his declaration after touring flooded areas in the western part of the state. His order says that the state stands ready to, quote, provide any tools and resources necessary to impacted communities. Andrew Beckett is a public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
We hear the term state of emergency on the news a lot, but what we don't hear as much about is what it really means in concrete terms. Now that one has been declared for all of Wisconsin, what changes?
Well, a state of emergency essentially directs all state agencies to provide assistance to local governments, so they have access to the resources they need in order to work on the response and recovery efforts that are needed in their areas. That includes stuff like providing access to sandbags more easily, coordinating aerial photography of areas where flooding has taken place, and working with volunteer groups who may want to provide shelter for displaced families or assist with cleanup areas in those areas. So it really is intended to kind of help speed up the process of getting assistance to those areas that are in bad need of it.
We have a lot of communities and a lot of individuals and businesses that have been affected. So how are priorities set, and do we know what the priorities are right now?
Well, the State Emergency Operations Center has been stood up since last week when the flooding first hit western Dane County. So, I mean, we've been actively working since then. Priority areas are pretty much any area that's actively dealing with dangerous flooding right now, such as those located along parts of the Baraboo and Kickapoo Rivers as they run through southwestern Wisconsin. The state's been in constant contact with emergency officials in those communities to make sure any requested resources are getting sent out as quickly as possible. We also continue to respond to requests for help in regards to the severe storms that swept through east central Wisconsin on Tuesday, producing at least 8 confirmed tornadoes and flash flooding in those areas. Governor Scott Walker's been touring many of those communities today, along with Wisconsin Emergency Management's administrator and the adjutant general, so they can have a better idea of the road to recovery that lies ahead for the people living in those areas. Like I said, the National Weather Service has confirmed at least 8 tornadoes so far that touched down as a result of Tuesday's line of severe weather. Those were in Fond du Lac, Dodge, Calumet, and Manitowoc counties. The National Weather Service is still surveying other potential locations, so that number could rise in the days ahead.
What goes into the decision to declare a state of emergency? What factors have to be in place?
We look at a number of issues in terms of the scope of the damage that's taken place. The immediate need for assistance to get out there is an important factor as well. We really want to make sure that resources are getting out to the communities that need them as quickly as possible, and having that state of emergency in effect essentially means that that process can begin moving faster.
How common is it for a state of emergency to be declared for the entire state?
In terms of historically speaking, I can't remember the last time that one was declared, but they do come up from time to time when you have serious incidents like this that have affected a wide range of areas. I mean, we have many counties across the state that have been touched by the weather systems that have come through in the last week and a half. So in a situation like that, it makes sense to kind of move forward with such a statewide declaration because you have so many resources that are needed and the ability to make sure that they get out as quickly as possible.
Andrew Beckett is a public information officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. We're talking about the statewide state of emergency that Governor Walker has declared. And Andrew, Wisconsin has a break in the rain today, a welcome break, but that doesn't mean the flooding goes away. What are the dangers that you're looking out for now?
Well, we continue to watch areas that may have standing water on roads or in the floodplain areas. I mentioned the rising water levels on the Baraboo and Kickapoo Rivers. Those are still very dangerous situations for communities that are situated along those areas. Those waters can move very swiftly and cause great amounts of damage to both homes, businesses, and public infrastructure as well. And they're also a danger to people who are out in those areas. We have roads that are closed due to damage or flooding, and people need to make sure that they're staying out of those waters, not attempting to drive through them. I mean, one of the biggest risks we face with any sort of flash flooding situation is people who decide to try and drive through waters. We saw it when there was flooding in Madison a week ago, where people tried to drive through the waters and their vehicles got stuck. The one individual who lost his life after getting stuck in floodwaters. If you encounter standing water, even if it's stationary, it's not actively moving, it's never safe to drive through it. You have no idea what road conditions may look like beneath the surface. You can quickly get yourself into a dangerous situation if you attempt to enter that water. Turn around, don't drown. Find another route, find a different way to get where you need to be, or wait until the water recedes before you move forward.
Well, and certainly one of the best ways is to avoid those areas in the first place. Where are some of the biggest closures that people should just stay out of the area of?
Anywhere, many of the roads that are along the watershed of the Baraboo and Kickapoo Rivers are areas where there's damage. We still have some damage to Highway 14, for example, near Black Earth from the rains last week. The easiest way for people to know information about what roads may be closed is to check 511wi.gov. That's the State Department of Transportation's road condition website, where they can get information on routes that are closed, road closures in their area or elsewhere in the state if they might be traveling this weekend for the Labor Day holiday. They may need to know in advance what conditions are like where they're going.
And what would need to happen, Andrew, for Wisconsin to get emergency aid from the federal government?
That's a process that will be ongoing, and it's something that the state will be looking at and Governor Walker will be looking at in the weeks ahead. This is a still very active response to a lot of the flood damage that's been going on, storm damage that's happened in recent days. Until we're out of the immediate effect of danger, assessments can't really begin. So it's very difficult to predict what type of aid the state might be able to seek, what it might qualify for, until we really kind of begin to collect those damage estimates. The important thing for people who live in these flood-affected areas is to collect their damage information, talk to their insurance agent and see what's covered and what's not covered, and then report that information by calling 211. That service is collecting information in many counties across the state, or will be able to direct you to the local agency that's collecting information. And that helps with the process of getting an idea of what kind of damage is out there, so that when the state begins the process of reviewing that damage, we have a better idea of what exists.
And as we begin to wrap up, Andrew, is there anything else you want to be sure people know if they're in an area that is dealing with flood or storm damage?
I mean, I would definitely mention again the avoid areas where there might be water standing on roadways. Never drive through those. And then also, if you are dealing with flood damage, reach out to 211. They are collecting that information, but they might also have access to local resources, volunteer organizations that are providing assistance to homeowners who are dealing with flood recovery. You might be able to find help with getting areas cleaned out that were affected by floods, or if you need help sandbagging and you're in one of those areas, they might have information on volunteer resources for that as well.
Well, Andrew, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed.
Happy to do so.
That was Andrew Beckett. He was talking with us about what a statewide state of emergency means for areas recovering from a week of flooding and storm damage. We're dancing here in the studio. I think that would be a great show to see. Piet, another big name at the top of the ticket for this year is Banda MS. They've been around for 15 years now. They're regulars on the Billboard Latin American Music Awards. Tell us about their music.
Yeah, they're a Mexican regional band. What makes this booking also so special for Los Dells is, my understanding is this is the first time Banda MS has played a festival. The Latin music industry in the States is really just booming. Streaming in the U.S. for Latin music in the first 6 months of this year is up by 50%. Last year, the profits were up over 30%. Led by, we saw this massive move with Despacito and Mi Gente. And there's just so much more interest in Latin music and a great service. surge in Latin music, but the Latin music festival scene is still in its infancy. So it's commendable that Los Dells would be able to book not just a reggaeton duo like we've seen in Adele, but also a banda group as well to headline. And they had that representation at the festival last year, and it was clearly very popular with multi-generations of people dancing along, older people and kids and babies, little toddlers dancing. It really spoke to the audience. So it's a smart move for them to book this group for a headlining slot.
Well, and let's take a little listen to Banda MS. This is their song, Tu Pastura.
Me da mucha tristeza ver cómo eres. No es que lo exagere, nada te reprocho.
Wow, I love that. It's so smooth, and yeah, I can see that being really popular.
I think it'll be a really big moment at the festival. They're going to be the closing night headliners on Sunday.
We're talking with Piet Levy right now. He's a music writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're talking about the Los Dells Festival of Latin Music happening this weekend just outside the Wisconsin Dells. And Piet, you mentioned Bad Bunny, which I have to say I love, love, love that name. Bad Bunny is an artist from Puerto Rico. He'll be playing on Sunday. And Piet, this is someone people might have heard from a song making the charts in the U.S. What was he on?
Yeah, so Bad Bunny is a featured player on I Like It, which is Cardi B's just kind of unstoppable summer smash. And so he's one of the artists on there. J Balvin's also on that track. But Bad Bunny is leading kind of the he's a reggaeton artist, yes, but he's also leading kind of the surging Latin trap movement and is quite popular. I mean, he was before I Like It came out, he was headlining arenas. He headlined an arena in the Chicago area, I think in February or January, and is certainly making the rounds. He's definitely a huge get for this festival, and it speaks to that last year they had Daddy Yankee, who was on Despacito, of course. So, you know, clearly the talent buyers are getting people that are really well known and are really hot right now, and Bad Bunny is about as hot as it can get in the Latin music world.
Before we listen to a clip of I Like It, can you tell us what Latin trap is?
Well, there's trap music, which is a subgenre of hip hop, which has these kind of like really kind of hard industrial beats, and there's a flow and cadence that kind of goes with it quite well. And this is kind of the Latin version of it. It's a little bit more, I think, melodic than you might get from kind of the stateside urban trap sound. And you know, that's just kind of in a nutshell. I think to hear it is really the best way to experience it.
Well, let's listen to Cardi B's I Like It that does feature Bad Bunny and J Balvin.
Chambean, chambean, pero no jalan. Tú compras todas las Cholambo, a mí me las regalan. I spend in the club, what you have in the bank. This is the new religion bank, el Latino gang. Está toda servieta, pero es que en el closet tengo mucha grasa. Ya mudé la Gucci pa' dentro de casa, yeah. Cabrón, a ti no te conoce ni en plaza. El diablo me llama, pero Jesucristo me abraza. Guerrero como Eddie, que viva la raza, yeah.
That's a lot of fun, and yeah, it's got that edge to it that kind of really drives that beat.
Yeah, that hard cadence, exactly.
Yeah, I like it. Piet, you wrote about Los Dells not having the most successful first year, but I think I read that 17,000 people went. Is that about right?
Yeah, so here's a little bit of the backstory. This is, again, I can't stress enough how interesting this story is, because, Latin music festivals, they have mostly been in cities. We haven't seen, like, these camping kind of festivals, and certainly not with the kind of talent that Los Dells has gotten. Like, you know, to have Maná last year, that's just, they're the U2 of Latin rock, and Daddy Yankee is like the Drake of Latin music. And to have them on the same festival in Mauston, Wisconsin is pretty mind-blowing. But the story is that the festival is run by Damon Zumwalt, who made his fortune with a security firm, Contemporary Services Incorporated. He founded it in like 1967 or 68, freshman year of college. It's now one of the largest crowd control and security firms in the world. It's used constantly at festivals and concerts, big sporting events in the last 12 Olympics. So he really made his fortune that way, but has been a lifelong fan of Latin music. And he's in California, but he visited a dude ranch in Mauston in 1998, fell in love with the land. land and acquired the land in the early 2000s. He has this multi-use sporting complex there on these 1,500 acres that he owns.
And we'll have to leave it there, Piet. I want to go out on some music. Piet Levy is a music writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about the Los Dells Festival this weekend in Wauston, Wisconsin. Stay with us. You're listening to Central Time.
¿Para qué me sirve mi cuerpo? Con el cerebro inventar, la mano escribir, la boca cantar.
You may be familiar with the concept of a doula. That's a non-medical support person who stays with an expectant mother through delivery and provides assistance after the birth. They're often a complement to a doctor or a midwife. That type of doula helps usher in a new life. It's not surprising, then, that a different kind of doula could provide support at the other end of a lifetime. Dr. Jackie Yeager is a board-certified physician in the specialties of family medicine and hospice and palliative care. In August 2017, she opened a solo palliative care practice in La Crosse, and as a certified death doula, she provides intensive bedside support for both dying patients and their families. She joins us from our La Crosse studios. Dr. Yeager, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, and thank you for having me today.
Well, tell us more about what a death doula is and what a death doula does.
Well, for me, there's really no one definition of a death doula. It's an evolving occupation. But for me, it's being a wise guide, someone who's been down this road before, who can then provide really a continuous presence and provide physical, emotional, and informational support to the family and to the person who's dying. I also see a death doula as someone who, at least it's my passion to be an educator and to really help the community learn how to be doulas for each other. I think it's a natural process, and it doesn't require necessarily a professional to manage it, but I think we've gotten so far away from knowing what to do at the time of death that we need a little bit of education out there.
And we will go back to that idea that all of us can kind of take some of those lessons and provide that support to others, but you are a certified death doula, and what does that mean? How does one become certified?
Well, right now, there's no one certifying agency out there. There are a handful of different organizations that provide training, and you can be certified. Now, I was trained in Boulder at the Conscious Dying Institute, and that consisted of two 5-day on-site trainings with a lot of reading and homework assignments in between times. Other programs are even online or maybe a weekend. So it's quite variable. The term, I think eventually we will coalesce into some sort of a certifying body, but right now it can mean a lot of different things.
And at what point in the end-of-life process does a death doula generally get involved?
Well, ideally, we'd be involved months before the death and do what I call the dying time care plan, where we really sit down and say, you know, where do you want to be spiritually, emotionally, physically, psychologically, and in a practical sense when you die? Where are you in those areas right now, and what are the steps we need to take to get you there? Often, however, I get called in much later in the process, and some doulas really specialize in being called in at the time of death and after death. So it's variable, and I think there's things I can do to help regardless of where people are at, because sometimes you don't have 3 months' notice. Mm-hmm. But the sooner we can start talking about the possibility, and of course we all know we're going to die, so we could all actually have a plan in place and know who's going to do what when that time comes.
So that dying time care plan, it sounds like in a way it's kind of a roadmap for the person who is near the end of their life, for their loved ones, for maybe professionals who are involved in one way or another to know. Is it primarily to know what that person who is actively dying would like, how to respect their wishes?
Yeah, and it's like a birth plan in some ways. We know that when women put together birth plans, they have to understand that things may change, but at least we have some knowledge of what might be just supportive of that person. I had a patient recently, and he was in my palliative care practice, so we knew that day would come, but we didn't really know how soon. But he mentioned one day, I said, well, what kind of music would you want playing? And he said, well, no kumbaya music. I want the Eagles. And so when his family got there and this dying started rather suddenly, it was really grounding, I think, for everybody to just know that that's something we could do right now. And so everybody pulled up music on their phones, and we started playing the music and felt like we were honoring his wishes. So it can be simple things, and they can be planned out elaborately, but it's grounding for everyone.
We're talking with Dr. Jackie Yeager right now. She is a physician. She's also a certified death doula, and she provides services for dying patients and their families in the La Crosse area. And hospice has become much more familiar and accessible in the past few decades. Jackie, how does a death doula differ, or are they really complementary approaches?
Well, I have been involved as the hospice medical director here in La Crosse for 8 years, so I'm really attached to and appreciate the role of the hospice team and work together with them whenever possible. The difference is that because of various funding sources and regulatory processes, the hospice the members don't get to spend as much time at the bedside as they would probably like to. Whereas a doula really kind of, I cancel my appointments as much as I can for that time and really spend hours and hours at the bedside during those last 3, 4, 5 days of life.
And what are you doing when you are next to the bed or, you know, wherever the patient has been made comfortable? What are you doing to support them in this transition? Death is not always a very dramatic process. There are long times where there's kind of not a lot going on. What are you doing as the death doula?
Well, a lot of what I do is give anticipatory guidance and say, okay, and sort of reassure the people that are there that this is the normal process. It is proceeding normally. It's maybe happening a little quicker or a little slower than what you'd expected, and kind of just drawing out what their questions are, what their fears are. And then it's a really good time to tell stories about the patient who's the person who's dying, maybe do some singing. And I've had I had a family recently who there was some, like most families, there was some trouble in the past. And so we used the Ho'oponopono ritual, which is an ancient Hawaiian ritual that basically has been put to music. And I played it with each person going into the room separately. And basically the ritual just says, I love you, please forgive me, I'm sorry, and thank you. Kind of over and over again. And then I followed that up with each person spending some time in the room alone with one of their loved one's favorite songs. And it was so touching because this 20-something-year-old grandson had really been raised by his grandmother and spent a lot of time in the car listening to her music. So he knew the Elvis songs. He knew the words to all kinds of songs you wouldn't expect a 20-something-year-old to know. And so we played those things, and I could hear outside the door him singing to his grandmother. And it was beautiful.
Jackie, you just touched on something that I wanted to make sure that we talked a little about. You know, families can be messy, and relationships can be messy, and just because someone's life is ending doesn't mean that all suddenly gets resolved. And so you're there for the person who is dying. You're also there for their loved ones, but sometimes it must feel like you're walking a tightrope trying to provide support to two different parties who might be coming at it from a very different way.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what you do as a doula is sort of just bring the families there's always messy, and we get worse at these times, not better. And so just being that calm, sort of unattached presence in the room, you can model some calmer behaviors and just sort of maybe even speak about the elephant in the room and say, hey, I know there's been some hard times in your past. Tell me more about that. It's my favorite words, tell me more. It can diffuse some situations and let people just vent a little bit, maybe outside the room a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I see so much healing in families. And if I can just sort of point that out during the time, then the families can recognize it too.
Dr. Jackie Yeager is a board-certified physician and certified death doula practicing in La Crosse. And we want to hear from you. Does the support that a death doula can provide sound like something you would welcome? If you've gone through the death of a person close to you, what kind of support do you wish you had had? Or maybe someone took on a similar role for you. Or perhaps you've been there to support others as they've gone through that final transition. Let us know about your experiences by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Dr. Jackie Yeager. We're talking with her about her work as a certified death doula. And we want to hear from you. If you've helped a loved one through the dying process, what support did you find most helpful? And what questions might you have about what services a death doula can provide and how they fit into other care? Tweet us now at Central Time WPR. Jackie, we had a question from Chris from Adams, and she was wondering how much death doula services cost, and I'm sure there's a range, and whether insurance covers it.
Right now, insurance does not cover these type of services. This is really sort of a new phenomenon. I charge sort of 3 days in advance and then refund anything that if it ends up being a shorter process. My desire is to not be thinking about how many hours I've been there, or, you know, if she stays another 15 minutes, does that mean we have to pay another $15? My charges are probably a little bit more because I'm also bringing my physician services. So I prescribe medications and I dose them and I really keep really close eye on things. The death doulas in general, it's a very wide range of charges. And in fact, some hospices are training volunteers to do some of this kind of work. Hmm. And so there might even be some free services available of this type.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, Jackie, we did a show about green burials, and we talked about how far away we've gotten from how we used to prepare the bodies of our loved ones for burial. How would you describe the process of dying in the U.S. today?
Well, exactly. I mean, in the last century, it's gone back from being something that happened naturally at home to something that happened secretly at the hospital and then whisk off to the morgue and the funeral home. And I think that we've discovered that being more present during the dying and even after the death helps with the grieving process. And so, you know, immediately after the death, I invite families to help me with the bathing, with just sort of a ritual bathing, maybe not an intensive one, but using some essential oils and soapy water, and just really the tactile part of washing your loved one is a very memorable way to say goodbye.
Let's go to the phone, and Jude is in Nisida. Hi, Jude.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What would you like to share?
Actually, my mother passed away about a year and a half ago. We had some issues with her being in the local nursing home, because I'm here in Nisida. And they actually, it was very difficult, but they actually kind of kicked us out, because they wanted her to go through palliative care, and I guess your guest speaker was talking about that. And all of this stuff was completely new to me. I had no idea what I was walking into. So, yes, what your guest speaker is talking about is it would be a wise idea for listeners to sit down and actually wrap your head around all of this, because it is quite difficult. It's very emotional. We do have family problems. So it was basically my brother and myself that really carried the brunt end of the burden. Mm-hmm. And when I walked into this, I was like, I had no idea We ended up going to Otoma Hospice. They were brilliant. They really helped me understand a lot of things that, I don't know, maybe the listeners don't understand, like active dying, what that is all about and how natural that is, and to be able to accept it as an aspect of life. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, the most important thing is they explained to me what actively dying is, what it looks like, and what you're experiencing at that point in time. And she also mentioned another thing that was really, really important to me.
Go ahead.
And that is some parents don't like sometimes their siblings, when they're really, really close, to watch them pass away, because she was just warning me about this. And what was really funny is the very last day that I was with my mother, I was always honest with my mom, and I told her, Mom, you'll have to excuse me because this sounds kind of funny, but I said, Ma, I really got to go to the bathroom. I'll be right back. And by the time I came back, and it was just moments, she had already passed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But having to understand that active dying really, really, really helped me settle my soul.
Yeah.
And we are also a spiritual family, too, so we also have that in our background, and that helps us out a lot.
And Jude, I'll share that actually when my mother passed away, the time that she actually passed was a very small window when no one was in the room with her, and that was very much in keeping with kind of, you know, her being a fairly solitary person. So thank you so much for sharing that, Jude. And Jackie, I want to ask you if you could briefly just explain for all of us what active dying is.
Right. Well, active dying is really just one stage of the dying process, and usually it's the point at which we realize the person is dying. Now, we may look back and say 3 days ago, yes, they were having some visions of loved ones that were dying, and you know, and it all makes sense then, but it's really the moment when you say, okay, I think our days, we're down to days and hours. And so, you know, the person is likely to be in and out of consciousness. They may be seeing loved ones and speaking with loved ones who've passed away. There's this near-death awareness that can be just the most amazing and beautiful thing if someone's there to explain it and not have it be so frightening. There's physical changes, and it helps so much if you know sort of what to watch for. Their breathing is going to become irregular. There's going to be pauses in the breathing. Sometimes, often, there's a rattle in the back of the throat. What is that? What are we going to do to prevent that? And, you know, is it hurting the person? Pointing out that, you know, this is a normal time when we would stop eating and drinking and, you know, and sort of pointing out the benefits of following the body's natural inclinations, meaning that you don't overload the body with extra fluids that it has to manage as it goes through the process.
I want to make sure we get to at least one more caller, and Mary is in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I wanted to tell Jackie this story. I only caught the first part of your information, but I'm a medical social worker, and my husband was in hospice and took a very bad turn for the worse and wasn't medically managed very well, and there was a rift in my family, and I was the only person taking care of him. There was no other family on any side involved. And on the day that he died, he needed like IV morphine. He was suffocating, obviously, but he needed IV morphine. It was 90 degrees out. I had no hospice help, and I know about death because I'm a medical social worker. I dealt with that in the hospital. I sub hospice all the time. But I needed somebody for me to talk to me.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I'm so sorry.
Mary, thank you so much for sharing that. And Jackie, I want to make sure that we do get to touch on this. Mary said very eloquently, even though this is more or less her field, she could have used help. She needed help. And, you know, we talked about the fact that there aren't that many death doulas around yet. They might be not be in the area where a family is. Are there elements of what you do, Jackie, that any of us could take on to ease our loved one's transition?
Yes. I mean, I think realizing that just because you're a medical person, when it's your loved one that's dying, you do need that help. And then sort of asking for it and maybe planning ahead. Who are some close friends who I could call when I need that time? What is my community? If it's not my family, what is my chosen community to bring around me in those times? But certainly, I guess the biggest thing would be just asking for help. You know, if that hospice isn't doing it, call another one. But recognizing that you can't do it all yourself and survive is really important.
What's the one most important type of support that you feel that you're able to give, especially the person who is passing out of this life?
I think giving them my calm presence so that their loved ones can just settle in and grieve maybe gives them a little bit of peace and ability to just pass without having to worry so much about their family. So I'm there for the person, just like the caller said, the mother is always a mother, always worrying about her children, and so maybe waits till they leave the room. But just knowing I'm there to take care of the family, I think helps the person pass more peacefully.
And if someone would like to find out if there is a death doula in their area, what would you recommend is the best way to do that?
Well, right now, there isn't one single clearinghouse, so I would just Google that, death doula, and your area, and see what happens. I know some doulas will travel, and I've even considered incorporating some kind of coaching over the phone for families that live far from me. But I know there's three or four different people working in the Madison and Milwaukee areas.
And you also said that some hospice programs are training volunteers who can provide similar services, if not exactly calling it death doulas.
Yes, or they may provide something called death doulas that looks a lot less intensive than what I do. So you really have to check out what they mean by that term.
Dr. Jackie Yeager is board certified in the specialties of family medicine and hospice and palliative care. She's also a certified death doula and provides intensive bedside support for dying patients and their families. And you can keep the conversation going by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. Would you welcome the help of a death doula? If you've gone through the dying process with a loved one, what do you think could have made it more peaceful? Or was it just how you would have wished it to be? Tweet your thoughts and experiences to us and share with others at Central Time WPR. It's pretty common to see posters or social media posts about a lost cat or a pup that's gone missing. But the Middleton, Wisconsin police recently got an unusual report of a lost pet, a hermit crab. A 12-year-old Middleton resident set her hermit crab outside in its cage to get a little fresh air, but the top wasn't locked and the crafty crustacean got away. Its shell is designed to look like a half soccer ball, and as a result, his name is Baller. No word on whether he answers to that, though. I called the Middleton police this afternoon, and as of 1:30, Baller is still on the loose as far as they're aware. So if you see a tiny half soccer ball scuttling around, let them know. It's not about a hermit crab, but I had to take the opportunity to get some B-52s on the show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
We were at the beach. Everybody had matching towels. Somebody went under a dock. It wasn't a rock.